You would get those problems in Robin B. Hood.
You would get or you wouldn't get.
Wouldn't.
I haven't seen it, so who knows? There may be untold darkness in Robin B. Hood, but I have a feeling you're going to explain.
Anyway, it's all crapness in Robin B. Hood.
I think the comments of the week on the forum is just discussing whether who's changing the nappy in that damn film. Is it like Lewis Koo or Jackie end up with... Ah, I can't even say it, just...
poop humour.
Yes, basically.
You wonder if they are CGI-ing it totally when they're doing the remake or a... Well, Teddy Chen is directing a movie called The Flying Guillotines. It's coming up sometime. How much of a remake it is of either Shaw Brothers movies, I don't know. But I really hope they try and do it physically and not CG the shit out of that, because therefore it would render, I think, anyway. I'm complaining about the movie even before it's released, but I don't like the idea of CGing the Flying Guillotine. But
I
who
think
knows?
You're going to be disappointed, Kenneth. Mm. I think they will CGI everything.
It makes life easy, unfortunately.
Well, the good news, by the way, Donnie Yen is not in it.
How is that good?
How is that possible, you were going to ask, rather. Donnie is in everything, but he managed to... The lead went to Chang Chen, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragons, Chang Chen, and the female lead is Zhao Chun from Painted Skin, Perhaps Love, and True Legend, of course. She plays Vincent Chow's wife. So, no Donnie Yen. Fancy that.
Oh, yeah, I saw True Legend, actually, didn't I, while I was away and not podcasting. You did a True Legend special, right? That film sucks ass.
It's actually lined up for a UK release at the end of the year.
With some 3D elements, apparently.
They were filming in 3D, weren't they?
Partially for a few sequences only and not the entire thing.
20 to 25 minutes. It's pretty good. It's kind of like a big-budget modern Shaw Brothers film. And then the arse just falls out of it after that.
1998 is the year where Wong Jing went on a exploitation tear again and made the Rape by an Angel series resurface again. But you know what, ironically, with the Rape by an Angel series? Mm-hmm. Only the first, to the best of my knowledge, was Category 3. The other ones were lingering around that 2B, and that probably, as some writers have talked about, that has to do with Wong Jing's influence in the industry. That his name is on it, we can be a bit more lenient in terms of the rating, because it's obviously 2B is maybe 15, Category 3 is 18, and box office numbers needs to be huge. So maybe Wong Jing can talk the censors down to a 2B and not cut the shit out of the movie. But having said that, Rape by an Angel 2, for instance, with Francis Ng and Athena Chu, or Athena Chu, it really pushes that 2B. Quite a bit. So it feels like a free. It definitely does. And the other ones as well. So 1998 was kind of a cool year for Category 3 cinema. It woke again, and this harsh movie, Shining Torture Chamber Story 2, no comedy. It's actually it's well worth watching. Tough to watch. But by the way, I'm going to mention one final thing. A friend of mine sent a link to, was a scene from an old Italian erotic romance movie, and he said, "Like, do you recognize that music?" I was like, I can hear it in my head, but I can't place it. I've heard it somewhere." Then he showed me a clip from Disciples of Shaolin, and Disciples of Shaolin actually stole that music for its movie, but it fits perfectly. It's chosen well, which is great. I mean, Shaw Brothers movies do have stolen music galore and library music and all of that, but this, maybe this was a library cue initially, but man, does it fit well. It's for a later segment in Disciples of Shaolin that is really emotional. So well chosen. Shaw Brothers knew what they were doing, even if they were stealing. They were making sure to steal good shit. I want to briefly talk about a second movie, if you don't mind. Okay, sorry.
I run for it.
I don't dare to now. That's too sad. But contemporary Hong Kong cinema we don't talk too much about. And again, I saw this movie about a week or two ago, but I saved talking about it for our show. And it's Choi Hak's Missing. That's not the title of the movie. It's Missing by Choi Hak. Choi Hak's Missing, directed by Choi Hak. And this 2008 movie, By the way, I've got to say, I realized that Choi Hawk was on a, you know, great role in the 80s and 90s and all of that, and he was a creative force in Hong Kong cinema, started new trends and all of that. So, but I don't expect him to do movies akin to that, that just want a good movie out of a director I like, you know. That's all I need. I mean, even if John Woo decides to make a romance, a romantic comedy, if it's a good romantic comedy, I don't care if it's John Woo doing it. So it's that simple to me. Missing is good for an hour, and it turns really catastrophical for the second hour. It's a 2008 ghost romance, essentially starring Angelica Lee, and it's a noble attempt at mixing up an emotionally charged romance and familiar horror tactics of the post-Ring era. It's inevitable that everything gets compared to Ring, but that's the era we've been living in since 1998 or whenever it was Ring. Ring 2 got released. I'm not talking about the remake, first and foremost, I'm talking about the Nakata movie. So the plot is about this underwater photographer called Dave Chen, played by an actor Guo Xiaodong. Don't know anything about him. He dies under mysterious circumstances during a diving expedition with his girlfriend, which is a psychiatrist called Guo Jing, played by Angelica Lee, of the Eye fame. And in the wake of this death and mystery, Dave's sister, played by Isabella Leong, she takes it especially hard and blames Guo Jing for the death. But that's least of Guo Jing's worries. By the way, this is all going to sound really familiar to people who've seen The Eye. So slowly descending into a world of constant ghostly sights, Guo Jing is. And one of those ghostly sights might be her dead boyfriend. But a vengeful spirit of a drowned girl doesn't seem to leave her alone either. So you have those forces colliding. For 1 hour, it's quite scary and quite creative, despite being very familiar. It even has an elevator scene akin to The Eye, where Angelica Lee is, someone is behind her and she's riding the elevator slowly and wants to ride it faster so she can get out. And it's that terrifying scene from The Eye, if you remember that.
I've not watched it since college. So.
Right. After this first hour, it doesn't get a good payoff. And I won't reveal what happens after the first hour. It takes a different turn. It reveals a whole lot of what actually the first hour was about. Essentially, it takes this us on this emotionally charged romantic side of the movie and focuses a lot more on the Dave Chen character and the Guo Jing character. It doesn't really work. It didn't affect me. And it seems like Choi Hawk just couldn't let go of this story. It goes on a bit too much. It's a bit too emotional and probably is a bit too long as a movie as well. I don't mind the mix of horror and romance, but it could have benefited from less is more because the heart was there in the right place. It was too much. Choi Hawk should have stopped earlier. And it's a 2-hour movie that may move fast, but still it felt like it ended way earlier, and even if it did end way earlier, I'm not sure he would have pulled off this mix, despite Angelica Lee, who's excellent at all times, really. I think she's a great, great actress, an affecting actress, but didn't really work as well. She can't do it on her own, you know, and so it works for an hour, and some are right to suggest that it turns catastrophical during the second hour. I wouldn't argue against that. Tony Leung Kar-fai appears in a small supporting role as I think he's a psychiatrist that Guo Jing goes to sort out some mental matters, and he has a wicked perm in this one. No, not a Samo-esque long hair perm, but still like whoa.
Ah, that's the benchmark there.
Yeah, exactly. So not really recommended, but you know, doesn't hurt to watch it. As such, but I like that Choi Hawk is making movies again and trying to. He seems like he's, you know, I'm gonna make movies. Try out new things. I mean, All About Women I haven't on my pile, and that may work. I don't know. It's a comedy, it seems. But everybody seems to agree that the Detective D movie is his return to form. And
that does look quite appealing.
I'm sure that's all right as well. I'm going to watch that eventually. Seems like a movie you'd want to see on a Blu-ray. big period movie and all that. But we'll see. And Triangle, I wasn't too impressed by his section in that, but the movie is okay overall. I like Johnny To's section in Triangle much more, the last third of the movie. Overall, that Triangle project didn't turn out as great as it sounds beforehand, three premium directors and all of that, but they try. I admire them for trying out new things. I mean, the likes of Johnny To don't need to fall back on the romantic comedy anymore. He did for a while. Now he can just do whatever he wants because he has the money to do so. Before he'd like had to mix it up between his PTUs and his Love and a Diet.
Mm-hmm. So that reminds me, how does Big Tit Zombie do? Because did that not still have a regular spot at the Prince Charles?
No, we've stopped doing that now because we didn't want to, what's the right word, overexpose or rinse it too much. So we've just left it as the DVD version for now, so people can go buy it on DVD. And we are next looking at some VOD sites for Big Tit Zombie, so stay tuned on that. In fact, if people want regular updates, Podcast on Fire obviously do a great job of talking about Asian movies releases. We've also got a newsletter which also plugs Podcast on Fire programs. And so if you sign up at terracottadistribution.com to the newsletter, then you can keep up to date of what we're doing as well.
Well said.
We're actually thinking about some more Solo Aoi type movies because that did really well. You'd be the first to know, actually. I'll let you know which one it is once.
cool. Too bad I had a great laugh the other day because I did show the trailer to it to a few friends and we came across like the original title where it is something like Hot Springs Strippers versus Zombies, yes. No, Dragon 5 or...
Yeah, Konyu Dragon. Was it a Strippers Vibe versus Onsen Zombies or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is a better title, but a Big Tit Zombie, it just simplifies it for people. But the problem we've had with that is during all our marketing, it gets firewalled when we send emails out or if we send newsletters out. Even if we're doing like trade talk, if we're talking to, say, HMV or someone, and we've got the subject Big Tit Zombie in there, they don't actually get our email because it's in their spam filters, so we have to actually call them up and say, look, can you unblock this email? Because it's important we talk about pricing and all this sort of stuff. And it's just been slightly to our detriment, but it's also been quite good because it's such an easy sort of title it's just a fun film.
You don't forget that one anytime soon.
It's not the world's greatest film, but it's also not the world's worst film by any means. Mm-hmm. And it's just fun. It's a good sort of Saturday night alternative to, well, not even alternative. If you're waiting for Family Guy to come on, just stick in Big Tit Zombie for a bit and then, press pause, watch the guy and just carry on watching it afterwards.
That's a quote for the ages. Someone should put it in an ad or on a box. If you're waiting for Family Guy, see Big Tit Zombie.
Watch some Solo. Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Man, the US release, I don't know if it's got a proper one yet, but the title they've claimed for this one is a little odd. Big Tits Dragon.
Oh, really? I think that was actually the original title. I don't know why we were sold a film called Big Tits Zombie, and then someone said, oh, look, there's another film called Big Tits Dragon, which we then thought was the sequel. But that was clarified by the sales agent saying, it's just, there's a whole sort of list of titles that they decided to go with, and they thought for Europe, Big Tits Zombie might be sort of the better title.
On the subject of Johnny To and different styles, have you guys heard anything about his latest, which is a romantic comedy?
Yeah, I think it's that Don't Go Breaking My Heart, I think.
Right.
The Daniel Wu movie. I've heard fairly good things about it. It was made specifically for the mainland with, it did have Louis Q and Daniel Wu, but also what I presume is a well-known leading lady from the mainland. And the guys at East Screen West Screen reviewed it because they keep track of the very newest movies, which is the advantage of their podcast. And they gave it a fairly good review, actually, because Johnny To and romantic comedies back then, especially back then, were just to generate cash for Milkway. And as the years went by, Milkway started to be able to provide for itself while making the movies they really, really wanted. So, but I heard decent things about it. I'm not too keen to watch it myself just because it doesn't really appeal to me. I probably don't have time, but it's good when you manage to make something, a romantic comedy, which is a boring, generic genre, and make it, something that critics say That wasn't too bad.
Yeah, I know we were talking outside the show about this, but and I know that you said this is a Taiwanese film, but I kind of find it fascinating that in the late 70s and early 80s, there were a lot of these sort of like big group of creepy crawlies and just throw them at the actors and actresses types of films. You know, like we were talking about The Devil, which is, you know, one where they use, if I remember, centipedes, wasn't it?
Maggots and centipedes, and, right, and there's a movie called Centipede Horror, which
Centipede Horror is a classic, right? And there's one with scorpions and all that. Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's creepy as hell, and Centipede Horror has the actress Margaret Lee actually just vomiting up live centipedes during the end of the film. Well, and it's incredibly brave, and again, I don't know much about snakes or centipedes, if it can be deemed safe, but this is still Hong Kong and Taiwan filmmakers we're talking about. I don't think necessarily safety regulations were akin to what you would encounter in Hollywood. Probably not. Yeah. So certainly Klaus and Shaw Brothers went to, you know, the snake route as well, where we have the Killer Snakes, which is this... kind of remake of Willard, only with snakes instead.
Right.
A really good movie, actually. So, but man, it's strong stuff.
Well, at the very least, what we've gotten out of this film is that we've managed to out-sleaze old Sleazy K twice in an episode.
But man, do I love this movie, and kind of hate it at the same time. But it's great. And thank you, Japan, again, for saving the movie, presenting it in widescreen on VHS once upon a time. That's that makes a whole lot of difference, even for this kind of movie.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting, and I don't mean to draw this out any longer, but I always find it interesting because a lot of the younger folks out there who are into Asian cinema don't know this, but, you know, like, 10, 20 years ago, it was so very difficult to find a lot of films. And a lot of times how we found them was through import VHS or Laserdisc copies from Japan. It was almost always from Japan, you know, where you'd find the widescreen, you know, whatever it was, you know, Cannibal Holocaust, you know, completely uncut and everything. You know, nowadays you can go down to, you know, whatever Kmart or whatever, you know, multinational corporation store you have in your area and find a lot of this stuff. But, you know, 20 years ago, you know, we had to trade videotapes and, you know, and most of these were dubs of, you know, Japanese, you know, laser discs and stuff. So there's a lot to be said now about, you know, the new generation of media. You know, it's not maybe quite where we want it to be, but I think, you know, it's great that there's all this stuff available now.
And from my side, a lot of the stuff that I collect never got any better than, you know, the ultimate edition of this movie, for instance, is the Japanese VHS. Yep. It's on various bootlegs now, right. The same VHS transfer, but that is the ultimate edition because it's English dubbed, whereas the Hong Kong release had no English dub nor subtitles.
Right.
Or nor widescreen transfer. So you really have to be content with the Laserdiscs and VHS for certain movies if you really want to watch them properly.
Yeah, I think it's certainly the case. You can make an argument that when you see director's cut from films of that era, that means something. It's not just like some crap that the director cut out of the film and then just decided to put it in to, you know, charge an extra couple bucks for the DVD. This was a lot of times with the older films. The director's cut was the version that got cut because of censorship, you know,
absolutely.
Whether it was, you know, the MPAA or the BBFC or whomever in each country would decide what the moral standards were for that country.
I want to, before we round this up, just what basically ask is our male actor, you know, an icon of Japanese cinema, because this movie, if not this movie, represents, you know, an iconic, at least one iconic performance.
Dioi Kebe, are we referencing?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, he's pretty famous, and it's kind of interesting. You could really say that Pale Flower was kind of like his Pulp Fiction to what John Travolta was.
Right.
In that he was already an established actor by the time he was cast in Pale Flower. But the thing was that he was already starting to get old at the time. I believe he was maybe like around 50 years old, I guess, when he starred in the film. And even though he's supposed to, I think, in the film be like around like late 30s, but he has kind of a youngish face. So anyway, he had kind of fallen hard on his luck in that, if I remember the story, he was working for maybe Toho at the time, and then he had messed up his lines in a particular production of theirs, and so they fired him. And so he was, you know, again, down on his luck. And, you know, it was like at that age, you know, it doesn't seem old for us. You know, they're 40, 50 years old is, you know, by Western standards, you know, by Western way of thinking, excuse me, not old. You know, we don't think of that as being old. It's like you still have plenty of time in your life. In Japan, that's considered kind of old if you have nowhere to go. You have no direction by that time. So what Shinoda wanted to do was he wanted to cast an actor who was that type of person, an older actor who was down on his luck. I think he had a chance to cast a younger, hotter actor at the time, but he thought this actor did not fit the particular image that he wanted this particular Meraki character to have. So, you know, one thing, you know, it's kind of funny you mentioned how Ryo Ikebe works. That was one of the reasons why he was selected. He has a very kind of cool, and as Shinoda refers it to it as being a very feminine kind of walk, you know. I think he actually says erotic, you know, it's kind of, kind of funny. But it's kind of true in a way. In one scene, you can see him in full profile walking. He does have a sort of like a feminine sort of walk. But then another thing was that I think he wanted an actor, and in the interview he said that an actor kind of like Mickey Rourke, who had, you know, fallen down in his luck and who had sort of had this experience of not so much being down and out, but having this experience of, you know, I guess like the character like slightly in a nihilistic mindset, kind of like, you know, oh shit. You know, there goes my life, you know, that kind of thing, you know. Yeah. So, I think it's a good fit. And actually, you know, it ended up being that Ryo Ikebe, who, you know, unfortunately passed away just last year, he went on to star in plenty of other films after that. So in a way, you could say it sort of, I don't know if you could say it rejuvenated his career, but it at least kept him alive, mm-hmm. you know, in the movie world. Excellent. I'm not too sure if you could say this is an emblematic film of his, because he was in several other films before that are pretty famous. One being Early Spring, which is an Ozu film. Snow Country, which was adapted from a very famous novel. But it is definitely a film, I think, for Westerners. If you see the actor, then, you know, if you're a big enough fan of Japanese film, you will recognize, that's Ryo Ikebe. Yeah, right. That's him.
I'm quite a fan of that quirky style of Takeshi's. Funnily enough, I responded to that back then. Anyway, they're always good to revisit.
I just want to make one more comment. I actually kind of find that comment kind of interesting, because I kind of feel that B. Takeshi's films, especially his more police or yakuza oriented films, they have this element of existential dread in them. You know, it's these yakuza who are facing their lives, who are looking at their lives and thinking, you know, what is this all about, you know, and also with the knowledge that, you know, they can be killed at any moment. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of that influence from a lot of B. Takeshi's films come from Pale Flower. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's directly so or if it's just, you know, something that's indirect, but, you know, I think that you could definitely draw parallels between Pale Flower and something like, for example, Hanabi, which is, you know, mm-hmm. Kitano's or B. Takeshi's most famous film here in the West.
I also watched those when I was a teenager, and I obviously didn't pick up on anything like that, but I always liked them, but the mix of quirky human violence, that was what I picked up back then. You know, these were kind of goofy, especially that movie as Sonatine.
Sonatine is a little more, it's a little more streamlined, and it has a little more of the humor involved in it. But if you rewatch Hanabi, for example, you know, that lead character, well, one thing is, you know, the ending of the film, which of course I don't want to spoil. But that lead character throughout the film, he's constantly sort of just staring off and sort of, and, you know, I think his mindset is really, you know, what am I supposed to do now? You know, because now I've been cut off from, you know, my network, so to speak. And what can I do? And I think similarly, Meraki and Pale Flower is also like that. You know, it's like he's reached this point of his life where he's thinking, where does it go from now? You know, I mean, you know, is this all worth it? And then he runs into this woman who has found this sort of direction, but it's a direction going downwards. Whereas I think Meraki is hoping somehow to have his direction going up.
So Stuart, thoughts on the Ikin Hour?
Sure, why not?
One enthusiastic way thoughts, I'll tell you.
Yes, a challenge, definitely. The man has over 50 films behind him now, so you've like guaranteed me for 50 more episodes.
Well, having said that, I like the responsibility, having said that, but, you know, we won't guarantee anything because things might change. I'm not saying we'll all die, but, you know, we might grow tired of covering Nick and Chang movies, all of them. But I'm willing to take on the challenge, you know, starting with, I guess, Ghost Without Tomorrow or Boys Are Easy. Like, to do two movies in one episode sometimes.
Possibly, yeah. He has done, like, again, half a dozen cameos, so there'll probably have to be a cameo episode flung in there just to knock all those ones out the park.
So, what was it? Dragon Heat, the cam.
Dragon Heat, Portland Street Blues. Yes.
My name is
Fame. His appearance there. I guess probably things like Float and Landscape are shorter roles than ours, so things like that could probably be covered in those.
Yeah, and it will be an easy show to do. We won't have, you know, a comedic format on it unless we develop one. And it'll just be talking of your favorite actor and me re-experiencing some movies, experiencing new movies, and perhaps finally some of the ridicule that is out there still. I think a little bit is still out there.
Learning to accept future cops.
I might...
silence.
Well, the reason I was silent, was he in that?
Future Cops.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, wasn't that Aaron Kwok? Aaron Kwok was also in it?
Yes, Aaron Kwok was also in it. Ikin was one of the bad guys.
Okay.
And he had fighting with Jackie Chung, and they crushed a car between them. And
that's why you're the Ikin Cheng scholar, not me. So that's the dynamic of the show. We're covering Future Cops this week, but he's not in it, Stu. Au contraire, mon ami, he is. And then you can be the master and just take over and rule. But that'll be fun.
I am the Moriarty to your Sherlock Holmes.
And as you said, as
I'm not
final...
like killing by it. In that. But
if so, I probably deserve it.
Your Ikin Cheng knowledge is inferior. You must die.
But as a final cap, I want to quote something you said when we chatted about this the first time. That even if we retire the network or finish the run of shows, Ikin Hour, if it does, another mermaid gets married. We'll have to dust off the mics and do another episode. And that very fact that you referenced that movie, that shows you're a fan.
Yes. It's either that or Let's Go Slam Dunk, or like the 3D version of that coming out.
Honestly,
that would have revived the genre, but I don't think it's done it so far.
Nah, I think I think we need some middle-aged people to star in that movie.
What, middle-aged Asian men can't jump?
Yeah, there you go. AKA, you know, the literal translation.
Let's Go Slam Dunk 2.
Look forward to that. Listeners, coming to Podcast on Fire Network soon.